Ever had one of those hungover Sundays where you wake up feeling like the universe is conspiring against you? For Marianne Power, that particular Sunday wasn't just another hangover. It was an existential crisis wrapped in crusty mascara and self-loathing. Despite her outwardly successful career as a London-based freelance writer with glamorous assignments, Marianne found herself at 36, feeling hopelessly behind her peers who were busy collecting life's milestones, marriages, homes, babies. While she smiled through their celebrations, inside, she felt increasingly irrelevant and lost. This crisis moment sparked a radical experiment that would captivate readers worldwide and earn praise from celebrities like Fearne Cotton, who called it a bloody brilliant book. Marianne's journey would become not just a personal experiment, but a cultural touchstone, examining our collective obsession with self-improvement and the elusive pursuit of happiness. Surrounded by the Kardashians on TV and the wreckage of her apartment, Marianne had her epiphany. She wouldn't just read self-help books as she had been doing since her 20s, she would do self-help, following every instruction to the letter. One book a month for a year, tackling her flaws systematically. Money problems, worry, weight issues. By year's end, she'd be perfect. What started as a neat 12-month plan quickly spiraled into a 16-month emotional roller coaster that would turn her inside out. Her first challenge was Susan Jeffers' Feel the Fear and Do It Anyway, which led to the most random fear-fighting to-do list imaginable: stand-up comedy, watching The Exorcist, skydiving, and even posing nude as a life model. Each experience pushed her further outside her comfort zone. The nude modeling left her feeling surprisingly empowered, while a spin class with people with rock-hard calves pedaling furiously in expensive Lycra proved more humiliating than being naked in front of strangers. Her comedy debut came after a weekend course in a Paddington pub basement. Despite her lifelong hatred of stand-up, find me funny, like me, love me, she found herself under the spotlight with a microphone in hand, telling the audience about her month of fear fighting. To her amazement, they laughed, not uncontrollably, but genuine laughter. The experience left her with unprecedented pride. The final challenge was skydiving, falling through minus 15-degree air at 150 miles per hour. Rather than feeling exhilarated, she was furious when she landed. "I'm never doing that again." She realized that facing physical fears gave her no reward. They weren't holding her back in normal life. Little did she know that falling out of the sky would seem like a walk in the park compared to what was coming next. Marianne's earliest money memory involved her father throwing cash in the air for her and her sister to catch. "Keep whatever you catch, but if it touches the floor, it's gone." After their frantic grabbing, her father announced he was joking. They couldn't keep the money. According to Kate Northrup's Money, A Love Story, this childhood memory explained Marianne's financial disaster. She had learned money is to be thrown around and never kept. Taking Northrup's 39-question quiz about financial health, Marianne scored a pathetic 639, confirming her tumultuous money relationship. She avoided bank statements, lay awake worrying about finances, and constantly said, "I can't afford that." Writing her complete money love story revealed growing up with extremes. Her Irish father came to London with nothing but made a fortune in property. They had Bentleys, Jaguars, trips to Harrods, and Disneyland. But this wealth taught uncomfortable lessons. People hate the rich, men screaming yuppie at their Bentley. Money makes you different, she longed to be normal, and wealth breeds guilt. Then everything crashed. Her father's health failed, recession hit, and by her 20s, it was all gone. Facing her finances was brutal. She discovered she was $15,109.60 in debt, $6,000 owed to a sister, a $7,000 overdraft on her business account, and $2,109.60 on her current account. Looking through her statements revealed endless financial energy leaks. Daily coffees, restaurant meals, 25 blow dries, 25 nail appointments, designer clothes, and mysterious $100 cash withdrawals that vanished into thin air. Following Kate's advice, she organized her finances into clean white folders, checked her balances daily while practicing gratitude, and gathered loose change from around the house. Despite a major spending relapse on her friend Sarah's birthday, $246 in one day, she was finally facing her financial fear. She realized her spending stemmed from never feeling good enough, buying clothes because she didn't feel pretty enough, squandering earnings because she didn't feel competent enough. Abandoning her financial housekeeping, Marianne turned to The Secret by Rhonda Byrne, which promised effortless manifestation through the law of attraction. Despite skepticism about the book's brown pages and scrolly font, she couldn't ignore how many people swore by it, from a friend who credited it for her pregnancy after years of trying, to another who manifested her dream apartment. Following the book's simple formula, ask, believe, receive, she focused on manifesting wealth. She visualized checks flying through her letterbox, downloaded a universe check, and wrote herself one for $100,000. She doctored her bank statement to show $12,380 instead of her actual negative $1,238 balance. When her mother called, she was predictably skeptical, asking if Marianne really believed in genies and bottles. Marianne even test drove her dream car, a blue Mercedes sports car, to help manifest it. Her friend Sarah challenged the book's premise, pointing out its disturbing implication that victims of war and tragedy simply weren't thinking positively enough. The book actually claims imperfect thoughts are the cause of all humanity's ills. Creating her vision board proved challenging. She realized she didn't know what she truly wanted, beyond vague notions of being skinnier, richer, and more successful. She started by searching for luxury homes in LA, but soon felt inadequate. She pivoted to a new vision, focused on happiness rather than materialism. Pictures of temples, travel destinations, yoga poses, and writing spaces. 4 days after creating her vision board, she received assignments to write about kale juice and upside-down yoga, both elements she'd included on her board. Perhaps there was something to this manifestation business after all, though she was still waiting for that $100,000 check to arrive. Marianne's first memory of rejection came at 8 years old, when two girls in the playground deliberated and denied her request to play with them. She retreated to the toilets in tears, a formative experience that left her avoiding rejection ever since. Now she tackled it head-on with rejection therapy, deliberately seeking rejection daily. Created by Canadian IT guy Jason Comley after his wife left him, the game flips rejection from something feared to something sought. She made a list of 16 rejection scenarios, starting with asking for free coffee at her local cafe. At a pub with her sister Helen and her friend Jim, she embraced a series of challenges: asking to play a stranger's double bass, he surprisingly agreed, requesting to pull her own pint, the bartender helped her do it, and joining a group of women she'd never met who welcomed her into their candid conversation. On Hampstead Heath, she spotted teenagers playing basketball and asked to join them. They coached her kindly and they discussed rejection from their perspective as young men approaching women. She secured her required rejection by asking them for money. Her biggest challenge came when she spotted an attractive man in a coffee shop, someone she'd noticed months earlier. Despite 4 hours of paralysis and self-doubt, she eventually gathered her courage, returned to the cafe after briefly leaving, and approached him. His friend tactfully departed, and the man offered her coffee. They connected immediately, sharing stories and eventually going for wine. After a sweet goodnight kiss, he told her he'd be returning to Athens to help his ill father, but wanted to see her again. Through this experience, she realized her greatest insight. She'd rarely been rejected in reality because she'd spent her life avoiding rejection entirely, at work, with friends, and in love. She had been failing by default, as J.K. Rowling put it, rejecting herself before others could. By June, 6 months into her self-improvement journey, Marianne had begun distancing herself from friends who lived in the real world while she was busy with self-help. She traveled to Italy for a fuck-it retreat led by John Parkin and his wife Gaia. The retreat was refreshingly relaxed, no 5 a.m. meditation, just morning sessions followed by free afternoons by the pool. Through simple but profound exercises, John taught the fuck it philosophy, not caring so much about outcomes while still pursuing what you want. In one exercise with Werther's Originals, they learned that when we relax rather than force things, we often achieve better results. In another, they discovered that when standing in places we choose rather than where others place us, we have remarkable strength and stability, a metaphor for living authentically. During an intense breathing exercise, Marianne confronted her fear of falling into a black hole if she ever truly relaxed. The exercise revealed how she'd spent her life terrified of vulnerability, especially with men, and how uncomfortable she was with genuine kindness. This breakthrough moment exposed deep-seated fears that had been controlling her life, illuminating why she'd always felt something bad would happen if she allowed herself even a moment of happiness. On the final night, despite her hopes and a romantic, moonlit walk with Jeff, a film director she'd been attracted to throughout the retreat, he disappointed her by talking about football instead of making a move. The retreat ended with a magical moment hugging trees under the moonlight, where she felt a profound connection to something larger than herself, a glimpse of spiritual reality that made her everyday worries seem insignificant. However, upon returning home, Marianne's fuck-it philosophy began alienating everyone around her. When her friend Rachel questioned her treatment of Sarah, she defensively insisted that self-help books encourage ditching negative people. At work, she'd completely lost interest, telling Rachel she didn't want to write about trivial things anymore. She was embracing new experiences, like naked yoga classes and attending spiritual events with her new friend Daisy, convinced she'd found her new tribe, even as her old friends worried she was crossing a line. 9,000 people chanting yes in unison in an East London car park, their voices echoing off concrete walls as they prepared to walk across burning coals, this was Tony Robbins' signature firewalking ritual. The air crackled with nervous energy as participants, including Marianne, signed detailed waivers warning of potential serious injury, burns, and even death. Despite trembling hands and racing hearts, they stood ready to take the literal and metaphorical step toward becoming their outstanding me. For 4 intense days, from 1 p.m. to 9 p.m. without bathroom breaks or meal pauses, Tony commanded the stage like a master conductor. His 6'7" frame towered over the crowd as he fired rapid-fire motivational slogans. Love is oxygen for the soul. Energy is life. Live with passion. His voice boomed through state-of-the-art speakers while massive screens projected his every gesture. His core message remained consistent. Anything's possible with the right mindset and proper state management. He methodically broke down the 6 human needs that drive all behavior: certainty/comfort, security, variety/uncertainty, challenges, significance, feeling important, love/connection, belonging, growth, expansion, and contribution, giving back. On Transformation Day, participants confronted their deepest limiting beliefs through intensive emotional exercises. Marianne's core beliefs, men don't like me and I'm crap with money, emerged through tear-filled journaling sessions. In a powerful visualization exercise, she was forced to face her feared future, alone in a cramped apartment, checking dwindling bank accounts, becoming invisible as she aged into her 50s. Then came the breakthrough moment. Hundreds of people jumping, dancing, and shouting their new empowering beliefs. Men love me. I am great with money, while visualizing their ideal lives in vivid detail. The ceremony culminated in the legendary firewall. Participants removed shoes and socks, forming long lines before glowing coals heating to 1200 degrees Fahrenheit. The actual walk proved surprisingly brief and manageable, almost anticlimactic, but its symbolic power was undeniable. Marianne left feeling invincible, armed with Tony's 10-day pure energy challenge, 5 a.m. wake-ups, detailed gratitude journals, nutrient-dense green smoothies, invigorating cold showers, lymphatic-stimulating bouncing exercises, and hourly positive incantations. Her new transformation regimen was extreme and all-encompassing, shocking 6 a.m. cold showers that left her gasping, carefully measured green smoothies in her newly purchased $400 Nutribullet, setting phone alarms for hourly affirmations, I am powerful and strong, success flows to me naturally, and obsessively testing her urine's pH levels. Between client meetings, she bounced on a mini trampoline for lymphatic activation, drank gallons of alkaline water, and strictly avoided wine because it's acid. This perfect me version lasted 8 days. Well, truthfully, 5, before she cracked under pressure and had just one glass of wine that predictably turned into an entire bottle of Malbec. By October, Marianne's self-help journey had taken a physical toll. She fell ill with a severe sore throat, shivers, and a hacking cough that persisted for weeks. Though her doctor diagnosed a virus requiring rest and fluids, she couldn't help seeking a self-help explanation. In self-help land, illness is never just physical. It always has deeper emotional roots. As her illness lingered, she realized she'd become completely self-obsessed. Her Facebook feed was filled with inspirational quotes rather than friends updates, and she'd neglected important relationships. Her mother bluntly suggested that all this self-focus wasn't healthy. After 10 months of self-indulgent self-examination and weeks of illness, she turned to Stephen Covey's The 7 Habits of Highly Effective People. Unlike modern self-help approaches, Covey's philosophy rejected happiness as a direct goal, instead positioning it as a byproduct of service and integrity. Despite her efforts to embody these principles, stopping drinking, exercising, performing daily acts of kindness, life seemed to mock her attempts. Her computer crashed, her phone was stolen, and her writing deteriorated to unreadable. The pressure to live perfectly according to these principles only intensified her self-loathing, culminating in a disturbing funeral visualization where she imagined her own suicide at 42. Her emotional state continued to deteriorate. During a Saturday night pub outing with her sister Helen, she dissolved into tears. Helen didn't mince words. "You need to go to the doctor. You need to get different kind of help. Antidepressants." Following Helen's advice, she took the ferry to Ireland, seeking refuge. For 3 days, she lay on a synthetic yellow bedspread, staring at the ceiling as her mind tormented her with thoughts of failure. Television became her lifeline, the tinny sounds of sitcom laughter providing fleeting comfort. After a quiet Christmas with family and a solitary New Year's Eve, Marianne faced the reality that her self-help journey hadn't delivered the shiny, enlightened version of herself she'd expected. Instead of becoming perfect me, skinnier, richer, with a cashmere sweater-wearing hottie, she'd become more of a basket case. Following a taxi driver's advice, she sought therapy, where the therapist recommended Eckhart Tolle's The Power of Now, a book she'd previously dismissed as New Age gibberish. What had once seemed impenetrable now read like the truth. Tolle described his own spiritual awakening at 29 while contemplating suicide in the London bedsit. His realization, "If I cannot live with myself, there must be two of me," led to an epiphany that transformed his life. Tolle explained how most of us live with a constant critical voice in our heads that comments, speculates, judges, compares, complains, often rehashing the past or worrying about the future rather than experiencing the present moment. Marianne followed his instructions to observe the voice in her head, and what she heard was grim. From morning to night, she tortured herself with mental records, the fat record that started the moment she woke up, the lazy record at breakfast, the "you're shit at work" record during the day, the drinking self-criticism at night. Watching TV at her sister's while berating herself for eating pasta, she had an epiphany. She loved her problems. Tolle explains that our ego, the false identity created from our thoughts and stories, wants to be special. Even if that means being especially miserable, we build our identities around our problems and fear losing them because it would threaten who we think we are. By month's end, she felt an unfamiliar calm. She slept better by feeling the energy in her body parts. On her morning walks, she noticed everything, the sounds, sensations, trees. At home, she experienced moments of pure presence, noticing the grain of wood in the table, the vibrant orange tulips, the taste of broccoli exploding with flavor. In these moments, she felt overwhelming love flood her body, seeing the aliveness in everything. She realized happiness isn't in striving, but in sinking into each moment, enjoying the work rather than the result, the sound of laughter, the taste of toast. In a room of 25 people sitting in a circle of plastic chairs, Marianne made her most vulnerable confession. "I've never been in love, and nobody has ever been in love with me." This raw truth she'd never even admitted to herself reduced her to tears. Through sharing vulnerabilities at the Hoffman Process Therapy Retreat, she discovered we all felt the same underneath: flawed, unlovable, not enough. After Hoffman, she discovered Brené Brown's work on shame, that intensely painful feeling of believing we are flawed and therefore unworthy of love. Brown argues the only solution is vulnerability and connection. If we share our story with someone who responds with empathy and understanding, shame can't survive. She rejects the term self-help because healing comes from sharing your story with someone worthy of hearing it. Marianne reconnected with her friend Sarah, whom she'd pushed away during her self-help journey. Sarah revealed she was 5 months pregnant, news Marianne had missed during their estrangement. Sarah didn't want her to change who she was. "You're usually warm and kind and funny. I'd like that person back." She challenged Marianne about the Greek, asking if she was running away from potential love. "Love doesn't have to be forever," she said wisely. "It can just be meeting someone and having a connection and learning from each other." That night, Marianne messaged the Greek, and they Skyped with video on. When she finally gathered courage to ask what he thought of her, he confessed she'd matched his ideal woman list when they first met. "I could not believe my luck," he said. She struggled to reciprocate, but managed to admit she thought about him. This was vulnerability at its rawest, feeling like she might vomit out of her heart. Yet in this openness, she was finally connecting authentically with someone who had consistently shown her his real self. For her final self-help book, Marianne turned to Louise Hay's You Can Heal Your Life. Hay believes all problems stem from two sources: holding on to resentment and not loving ourselves. Her solution involves forgiving everyone who's wronged us and practicing daily affirmations of self-love. Standing before the mirror with unwashed hair, mascara-streaked cheeks, and a spot on her chin, Marianne practiced Hay's affirmation: "I love and approve of myself." She examined her body without the usual harsh criticism: the drooping breasts, the belly that showed her long-term relationship with cheese on toast and wine, the unshaven legs, cellulite, and stretch marks. Instead of berating herself, she smiled and repeated the affirmation, feeling the futility of constant self-criticism. 3 months after her self-help journey, staying at her best friend Gemma's cottage in West Ireland, she reflected on her experience. Her self-help year seemed disastrous in many ways. Her debt grew, her productivity plummeted, she gained weight, became delusional about the universe providing, and lost a friend. She was self-obsessed, constantly analyzing herself and chasing perfect me while growing increasingly unhappy. Yet the journey ultimately helped her realize she didn't need to fix herself to be loved. At Hoffman, sharing her hidden flaws with strangers became transformative, showing her she was accepted as she was. Through exercises like confronting her negative self-talk, she experienced moments of pure love and connection. Though seemingly selfish, seeking happiness allowed her to move beyond self-loathing and connect with others. Looking back at herself in the mirror, she saw not flaws, but a woman who had done crazy, brilliant things over 16 months. She was now done with trying to eradicate her bad bits or striving for constant perfection. She was tired of affirmations, faking happiness when she wanted to be grumpy, and feeling guilty about simple pleasures like cheese on toast, sometimes the best part of my day. After 16 months, she could finally look in the mirror and be okay with what she saw. But it was time to step away from her reflection, both real and metaphorical, and embrace life as it came, imperfections and all.